Welcome to the Beveridge Report. Today, we are joined by Professor Brian Kaplan, a renowned American economist and professor of economics at George Mason University. He's known for his unorthodox views on various economic and social issues. We're excited to have him here to share his insights and perspectives on current economic trends and policy. In this first part of our conversation, we will discuss the importance of challenging the status quo, debunking the myth of the rational voter, and advocating for open borders. Special thanks to Aditi, Alice Odonka, Sylvia, and the LSE Economics Department for making this episode possible.
What motivated you to pursue a career in economics?
I knew from a young age that I wanted to be a professor of something. Originally, I actually wanted to be a professor of English literature. I loved novels, short stories, that kind of thing. I had fancies of being the next Shakespeare. Then before I started college, I read Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, which seemed totally crazy to me because she had all these things about free markets being able to do things that I never heard they would be any good at. That got me curious, is this woman totally crazy or what? And I started reading especially free market economics. That's what I did a lot in my 12th year in high school. Once I was in college, then I learned normal economics too. And said, all right, well, it's more complicated. But anyway, that is the story, is I started learning economics to find out whether Ayn Rand's views about the desirable economic policy were even feasible. And from there, I just got very interested in what you could call the science of human nature, just understanding what makes human beings tick, why societies work the way they do. I guess I could also add that when I was in college, I was then weighing, should I be an economics professor or a philosophy professor? And really, I spent a lot of time saying, well, each field has its terrible problems. Which set of terrible problems bother me the least? Finally, I said, well, if I do, my idea was I would rather do big questions and which, but neither field will let me do big questions. And I'd rather do small questions in econ than small questions in philosophy. As it turned out, I actually was able to manage my career so I could do really big questions in economics, and everything worked out great. And of course, economists make a lot more money and have much better job prospects. So that's how it happened.
Brilliant. And as someone who, consistently challenges many conventional ideas through your books and blogs, mm-hmm. why do you think it is important to evade dogma and to think critically and differently?
The value of evading dogma is almost by definition, right? If it's dogma is normally there's a strong connotation of it being wrong, but at minimum it's poorly thought out. So yeah. I was like, what's the point of that? What's the point of avoiding poorly thought out stuff? Yeah, well, it's almost certainly wrong, oversimplified. So yeah, there's that. In terms of what's the value of thinking critically, it's really the only alternative to just accepting what the standard views are and repeating them. Doesn't mean that it works that well. Of course, most people think for themselves, end up with a bunch of nonsense too. If you look at your typical conspiracy theorists, to say they're not thinking for themselves seems kind of unfair. They're doing independent thinking. Yeah, all right. So sometimes they're repeating what other conspiracy theorists think, but they're synthesizing. They're getting a bunch of different conspiracy stories and putting it all together. So there is that danger. I would say that a big part of critical thinking is also just being honest. What can I even really know myself? To calm down and say, all right, yeah, everyone wants to have some grand theory of the universe, but this is really all based upon the trustworthiness of these sources. How do you even know they're trustworthy? I mean, a lot of what I would advise people to do and what I try to teach my students is, well, just start with something you can see with your own eyes. Like when I wrote my book on education, whenever I talk about education, I say, look, before we go into any academic evidence, let me remind you, you all have a decade plus of firsthand experience with this industry. So if someone tells you something that doesn't fit your experience at all, think twice about that. Think three times.
Why do you think these dogmas exist in the first place?
What I would say is that most of the dogmas that people care about, they're really substitute religions. This all sort of goes back to the question of why do we have religion? Right? There's a let's see, I think he has a psychologist named Pascal Boyer, and his story is, well, there's quite a bit to do it, you know. So he actually does experimental religion where he makes up new religious stories and just measures their memorability and their appeal, that kind of thing. I think a lot of what we can say about religion is it is historically of some use in fusing people together into a group. And you say, well, yeah, but why does that have to be so silly? And story that my colleague Robin Hanson comes up with is, well, you can't really fuse a group together with a theory the sky is blue, because everybody believes that it's obvious. It's much better for showing loyalty to get people to say something that's crazy, because then you are subordinating your own intellect to the group and saying, yes, it might appear that the sky is blue, but it's actually purple. And everyone goes, yes, it's purple. It's absolutely purple. Right. And then this way you can really sort of put people to the test. It's kind of like getting someone to pick up hot metal with their bare hands. And it's like, well, you know, like anyone could just pick up a peach and that wouldn't really show loyalty to the group, but picking up hot metal, there's something there. So I would think that a lot, at least, of the dogmas that people have, it's sort of an extension of this very ancient motive of religion. So really, if you could understand why primitive religion exists, then I think you could understand dogma more generally. It's part of group. Yes, you know, a lot of it is part of group identity, right? And then when you think about it more, say, well, but it seems like a lot of this is the individual cares more about it than the group even does. So one where you have to again go back to our ancestral environment where there's really just so little privacy, where everybody knows everybody's business. And in an environment like that, it's really important to sincerely care about the group. You don't want to be someone that's looking constantly for a way to weasel out of group loyalty because you're going to get caught. So I would say that evolution actually changes our sincere feelings, not just it doesn't just give us a desire to please, but it actually makes us genuinely care about other people's opinions, because in that ancestral environment, other people's opinions are the difference between life and death. Fast forward to the modern world where you can be really weird and nothing bad happens to you. I was just in Japan, and of course, the Japanese, they're still masking it outdoors like 90, 95%. Now, why are they doing it? Well, conformity. But it seems like a lot of that conformity is internally motivated at this point. Oh, I couldn't bear to not to be different. And sort of the strongest sign of this is, in fact, not just a Japanese trait, but a general human trait. Almost all the Westerners are masking outside of Japan too. It's like, oh my God, I couldn't bear if the Japanese thought ill of me. You know, I just walk around like I own the place, but I'm re clearly really weird.
Let's just jump into some of your work, in particular your book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, where you looked into four different biases. Can you please give us a short introduction of what these biases are and how have they evolved?
Right. The four biases that I talk about in The Myth of Rational Voter are, first, what I call anti-market bias, then anti-foreign bias, make-work bias, and finally pessimistic bias. These are, at minimum, long-standing belief gaps between economists and the public in the best way to think about how the economy works. I also argue that these are cases where the experts are generally right and the public is generally wrong. What are they? So anti-market bias, I say it is a general human tendency to underestimate the social benefits of markets. This does not mean, of course, that the typical economist is a free market radical. Far from it. That's totally false. But still, compared to a normal human being, even a left-wing economist generally has more favorable views about markets. You can look at, say, Paul Krugman and look at what he says about labor markets or international trade, and compare it to, say, my dad, who's a very conservative Republican. And yet, by a lot of measures, Krugman is more pro-market than my dad is. Like, Krugman is much more willing to say, yes, well, like when markets go and destroy jobs, it's actually a good thing because it's a way of saving valuable labor, and markets are good at figuring out new things for people to do. Or for international trade, saying this is how we actually wind up getting the biggest bang for our buck by division of labor. Whereas my dad would just have a much more negative view of these things. All right, so that's anti-market bias. Anti-foreign bias says that people are especially pessimistic about any kind of economic interaction with foreigners. Make-work bias says that people tend to judge economic performance based upon employment rather than production. So when they see that people are losing jobs, say, ah, that's bad. Even though if we had saved all jobs for the last 200 years, almost no progress could have happened. We'd still mostly be farmers. And then pessimistic bias, this is a tendency to underestimate the past, present, and future of the economy. Again, does not mean that optimism is always justified. In the middle of COVID there, I was actually telling people, look, we are in fact too optimistic right now. The economy is doing terribly despite official statistics because so many products are unavailable. If we were properly measuring what's really happening, we would say that we've had a 30% fall in our living standards in just a matter of a month or two, the worst crash in recorded history. So that's where I was saying official data is actually misleadingly optimistic, but that's not the norm.
Where do these biases come from?
Yeah, good question. I mean, so there's an economist, Paul Rubin, who wrote a piece where he tried to give an evolutionary story for all of them. It's a great effort, but the only one that I thought he really had much of a good story for was the anti-foreign bias. There, his story came down to, for almost all of human evolution, it was completely justified to think of foreign humans as a danger, because in a hunter-gatherer economy, at best, it's zero sum. If other people show up to say, oh, great, we can trade with them. Well, what are they going to trade? Our animals that we hunt, right? Great, thanks a lot, all right? And then, of course, that's even ignoring the very common scenario where that other group of humans just murders all the men in their sleep before dawn and then goes and enslaves the women. And that's, again, also very common throughout human history. So, again, I say it's not a bad story about why we have the xenophobia. 10,000 years ago, it was reasonable to be very afraid of foreigners, and we just haven't adapted emotionally all that well. For the others, he did have stories, but I just don't find them very convincing. Like, he had one saying, well, zero-sum thinking makes sense in a world with very little economic growth. And I said, look, when you are on the edge of starvation, you should be looking for any possible way to better your condition. And there are bet gains to trade in even a very primitive environment. So it is not sensible to be opposed to or to just act as if there's no gains to trade because you're really poor and there's no growth. It's really in this very primitive economic environment that you should be trying to grab any little advantage that you could possibly get. So I didn't think that made very much sense. I mean, in terms of what's going on, I have been developing a bigger story, and I think which encompasses these biases. It's unfortunately a little bit vague, but if you combine it with some other knowledge of human psychology, then it's helpful. So there's a concept in psychology called social desirability bias. It's a very simple idea. It just comes down to when the truth sounds bad, people lie. And if the lies become ubiquitous enough, then people just, they sort of harden into dogma. People don't even think about them. They don't think they're lying anymore. Right? A classic example would be something like, am I fat? Like, well, there's only one socially acceptable answer to that question, regardless of my actual weight, right? And you can see this in things like, did you vote? People overstate their voting rates. Did you go to church? They overstate church attendance. But you can see it even in things like, do you want to come to my party next week? And the socially acceptable answer is to say, oh, no, I can't. It's like, unless you are going to be, stranded in the middle of Mongolia, you can come to the party. You are physically capable of arriving at that time, but you just don't want to. So, however, it is not socially acceptable to say, yes, well, I totally can come, but I have something better to do with my time, so I'm not going to come. That would be another example of social desirability bias. Story that I've been coming up with in general, sort of general story about politics is that really, the heart of politics is just taking social desirability bias and turning it up to a high level, right? And I think about all four of these biases fit there. But you could then say, yeah, but why does what sounds good sound good to us? And there's a lot of particular things you can say, but it's hard to come up with a really general story. But it doesn't bother me that much just because it seems to be such a human universal for some things to not sound very good. You might say, well, why does it sound good? Why does it sound bad to say, I'm super rich, right? We see in the data, there's almost no human being on earth who will self-identify as rich, right? You might say, that's kind of weird. Isn't it good to be rich? Wouldn't you want people to know it? And it's like, well, you do want people to know you're rich, but you don't want to be the person that makes them know it. You want to go and be modest and cool about it. And you want other people to say, oh my God, that guy's so rich, right? While you say, oh, I'm just a regular guy. I put my pants on one leg at a time. I'm upper, you know, upper middle class. I have heard people worth $100 million claim to be upper middle class, right? So it's, and again, if you say, well, why is it? And you might say this is just like an American thing or an Anglosphere thing, but I've seen data for all of Earth. There's not a single country on Earth where more than a tiny share claim to be rich. So clearly this is that we just have a general disdain for people so arrogant as to claim they're rich. And I think you can put a lot of the of everything else going on. It's not that hard to actually slot it within, you know, for those four biases. Like, you know, like what's going on with anti-market bias? Well, really, to be pro-market, you wind up having to say some good things about business and the rich, and that doesn't sound good. You want to talk about the people, not business and the rich, right? And for foreigners, it's like, oh well, you know, we're great foreigners. Right. Yeah, there's that element. And again, this is every human society. It's not just some particular society that is anti-foreign. Again, you know, like, you know, if you're wondering what's going on there, something else that fits with social desirability bias is this. Individual bragging is frowned on by every society I've ever heard of, but group bragging is actually okay and can in fact be considered to be great. Like, I am the best. No, don't say that. But we are the best when you're on a team. That's fine. In fact, if you fail to say we are the best, that marks you as being someone that is an enemy of society. Right. And again, with, you know, make work bias, you know, well, definitely sounds good to show sympathy for someone who's out of work and is struggling to go and say, well, but in the long run, this is going to lead to economic growth. Like, you need to sound like you're insensitive to people. And again, on the pessimism of just being negative about the economy. Right. This is one where, again, it is not like a general pessimism where if you were to go and say something like, what about the progress of our society and eliminating racism or something like that? There's a bunch of areas where it's okay to be optimistic and say, oh, we've made such strides. Again, it's more of you don't want to go and affiliate with business and the rich and that. And so really people are pessimistic about business, about those things specifically. And that's so tied in to the way we think about the economy. So maybe that's what's going on. But yeah, I mean, I'm working on, I'm doing a book on the social desirability bias generally and how it distorts our understanding of economics and politics. So hopefully by the end, I'll have a better understanding.
You mentioned in your book that it is irrational for people not to support free trade. Mm-hmm. However, wouldn't believing in protectionism be the rational choice for a 50-year-old who will be made unemployable by foreign competition in a small industry someplace? So for that person in particular, wouldn't that be the rational choice?
Right. Well, there's you have to draw a distinction between two things. One is understanding what free trade actually does, all the positives and all the negatives. And the other one is whether you're personally in favor of free trade. If, you know, like, you know, you can make it even more extreme and say, well, what if your whole business depends upon protectionism? Right. Well, then would it not be totally rational to favor protectionism? And I say, well, look, it's in your rational self-interest to favor protectionism. That does not mean that it makes sense for you to deny comparative advantage or deny the upside just to say, yeah, well, I don't get much of the upside. Right. So that's where in the book, I tried to focus on descriptive views about what economic policies actually accomplish or what economic forces are actually doing, which is then distinct from whether the net is beneficial for you or not. Now, I go on in the book to say that there's a lot of evidence in political science that people's political views have very little to do with their objective self-interest. Rather, people are generally forming their views based upon what they consider best for society. So in that case, what I'll say is that if your goal is to support policies that are best for society and you also are a protectionist, that's where I would say that you are irrational. But again, irrational because you have predictably false views about what the effects of these policies are, and they are then inconsistent with your goals. In terms of the person whose business would be destroyed by free trade, what I would say is, well, look, they can have irrational beliefs about about the effects of protectionism, like if they just deny all of the good things about free trade, it could still be that they end up supporting the same policies they would if they were rational and self-interested.
That's, and recently in an FT article, it was noted that millennial voters, both in America and the UK, are not growing more conservative, or in particular, are not voting more conservative as they age.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think about this in the context of your theory of the rational voter?
Well, it wouldn't be a very good claim for me to say that I've predicted this, because this is not true for all the other generations.
Yeah.
So if you have a theory and say, well, this perfectly predicts what the young people are doing these days, well, then doesn't it directly contradict all the evidence from all the previous generations we have data on? So, I mean, honestly, this is one where I don't want to claim too much for my story. There's a lot of things that are consistent with being irrational, right? And so I want to say, look, in general, what I expect is that people's political views are going to be a lot like religious views. They're going to be highly based upon, first of all, they're not going to make a lot of sense. Second of all, they're going to be highly based upon conformity to a culture or a subculture. But beyond that, and then I guess I would also say there are just some things that to almost all humans sound good or sound bad. Again, like almost all human beings think it sounds good to say, I stand with the people, not the rich. All right. So that's something that's very universal. And again, there you go, or to say that like my country comes first. Let's say almost everyone thinks that. Again, even people who nominally are cosmopolitan will normally very quickly fall into nationalist thinking. So there's that. But yeah, in terms of the details about what's going on with one particular group having one particular view, that's where I would say, no, I mean, I don't really have a theory that predicts that specific thing.
Moving on to another subject, while the public quickly adopts new products and technology, mm-hmm. they're however more hesitant about vaccines and other medical innovations. Mm-hmm. Why do you think this is the case?
Yeah, well, I would go back to that idea about politics as a religion, and say that any time that something has this religious halo around it, here at least, there is a greater likelihood of things going wrong. In the case of, I would say, in general, people have now, people have not had that big of a problem with vaccines. So, there has been a weird revival of being afraid of vaccines in the last few decades. It was a period where they were just super widely accepted. And what was going on? Well, they were not politicized. There wasn't, when I was a kid, it wasn't like chicken pox is Republican or something, or the chicken pox vaccine is Republican and smallpox vaccine is Democratic. It was just something that people thought was a good idea, and it was totally apolitical. So yeah, I think the main thing going on with COVID vaccines is they got politicized. They got linked in with the left, and then leftists want to do them to a greater extent and rightists want to do them to a reduced extent. Now, as to how that happened, it's really weird what happened. Because in terms of logic, the obvious thing is Trump was behind Operation Warp Speed, right? So Republican president goes and expedites or bends a whole lot of federal drug regulations to get a drug to be released to the public many years earlier than it normally would. But then something weird happened and he didn't really claim that much credit for it, which is weirdness squared. Trump not claiming credit for something, he claims credit for all kinds of things he didn't do anything. He had no reason to claim credit for. Here he actually was involved and he didn't seem like he really tried to claim much credit for it. And then he also allowed it got announced. The approval, I want to double check this, but I believe that the first approvals were announced just a little bit after the election. He didn't go and just bring the head of the FDA in 2 months earlier and say, hey, you're dragging your feet today or you're fired. Right now, if he had done that, then I think we would see an opposite pattern in the U.S. at minimum. And the U.S. is so focal to all global politics, I think this would have transformed it all over the world. I think that it then would have been a left-wing thing to say, I don't want these vaccines that have been rushed through without any regulatory approval, right? It's the Trump vaccine. Who knows what's going on there? I'm not sure about this, but it's at least pretty plausible that that it was because it was politicized. Now, as to why it got politicized this particular way, it's weird. I don't know about the UK, but actually, pre-COVID, anti-vaccination was primarily a left-wing cause. It was basically anti-technology hippies that were, you know, in communes and such that weren't going and vaccinating their kids, saying, it's nature, man. You don't want to mess with nature. And then suddenly vaccination has become a left-wing thing. So again, the main thing to understand here is this is a very similar course to a lot of the history of religion, where it's like, well, why is transubstantiation the Catholic doctrine and not the Protestant doctrine? Like, why, what? Like, why is it turned out that way? Right. And someone who knows this religion can say, well, it's all very complicated. And you have to, there's a certain Council of Nicaea and something, something. Right. And in a way, that's an acceptable explanation. But on the other hand, you still have to be scratching your head and saying, so odd how things turn out. Now, as to why it is that people are actually really risking their lives over this nonsense. The big claim that I have in the book is that when the stakes are high, people actually generally are more reasonable. Here, my honest answer is that while vaccines have saved a lot of lives, the actual expected value of the difference is in fact fairly small for most people. Vaccination rates are in fact high among the elderly. I know the US, right? Regardless of politics, remember the elderly in the US tend to be more Republican. They have really high vaccination rates for the first two shots anyway. So it does, like, I will at least claim that vindication, that for the people that had a really high risk of death, they really did in fact have high vaccination rates. Younger people, I would say it's just not that big of a risk for them. And so it's not all that surprising that someone will go and allow their political views to sway their decision for something where it does not matter that much anyway. And in fact, I would actually go a bit further and say that for really young people, it does seem like in hindsight that the side effects are, at least for boosters, are higher than the gain. So, I mean, ultimately this is one where it's, the level of complexity is actually beyond what almost anyone wants to imagine. Because if you go and say, well, it's not really a good idea for 20-year-olds to get boosters, so people, oh my God, you're an evil Trumpian vaccine denialist. And it's like, but this is a sub question here. And you can't just use the general story, vaccines good, to resolve whether it makes sense for 20-year-olds to get a third shot. So just calm down and let's go and unbundle these questions and think about them separately in a reasonable manner. Which again, of course, if the person likes you, they'll say, oh yeah, terribly sorry. And if they don't like you, then it's back to the the cross.
You've mentioned a few times how politics is quite synonymous with religion in the olden days. So what do you think about the fact that as religion is losing its popularity in most parts of the world, do you think politics is perhaps taking the place of religion in people's daily lives? And secondly, has the role between politics and religion, the relationship between them, has it been constant across history?
All right, so the second question is harder. The first one, I claim no originality here. Almost any historian of the last 250 years will say, yeah, politics became the new religion. Starting with the French Revolution at the latest is when, for a significant part of the population, politics became a substitute religion, right? And so in the French Revolution, of course, the radicals are atheists and or at least definitely anti-clerical, but actually a lot of atheism too, right? And then do they then say, well, let's just calm down and be reasonable? It's like, no, let's have a giant political fanaticism. Let's have the cult of man. Or I'll do that with a French accent. Let us have the cult of man. And off with their heads, anyone who would deny this great, the truth that we have discovered. What truth is that exactly? Man. All right, so this has been going on for a long time. The big one of the 20th century was, of course, Marxism-Leninism. But it is true that religion held on for a long time in a lot of parts of the world. And in the Western world now, religion is just crashed and burned. It barely has any say. It's the religion that is trying to cozy up to politics, not the other way around. This is where you'll have professional clergymen going and trying to explain why, contrary to 2,000 years of Christian teaching, it's actually pro-LGBT. It's like, have you read this book? What about the death penalty for this stuff? Parts, there's very explicit stuff in the Christian Bible and the Jewish Bible about this, and there's no way you can reconcile this with modern sensibilities, and yet there's a whole bunch of clergymen that are just desperately trying. So yeah, politics definitely has the upper hand now in the West. In the Muslim world, it's different. Where there, it is Islamism, which is, it's there with the religion. I think it's, in fact, stronger than it was 100 years ago in the Muslim world. Leon Trotsky had, one of his most absurd predictions, he claimed that the whole Muslim religion would just vanish it was yet a metaphor, something like paper before the wind or something like that, once Marxism-Leninism shows up. You had a lot of errors, but that was one of the most laughable things that he said in hindsight. We've got a big fall in the power of religion relative to politics all over. Yeah, and in terms of daily lives, I would say that for most purposes, politics has taken over. There's one difference, which is we don't really have any analogy to attending religious services for politics.
What about political rallies?
Well, here's the thing, is hardly anyone goes to those. It's such a small share of the population. In terms of a weekly social group that you go to talk about politics, and you then get to know these people on a personal level, this is actually super rare. And so this has not happened in politics anywhere that I know of. You may say, well, I have some friends who have a group. Yeah, but that's so rare. Even today, there are way more people going to weekly religious services than weekly political gatherings. And in that sense, you may say this is the particularly tragic, because the one really good part of religion is giving people a group of friends to hang out with and letting people bond. I would say that all of the evidence about religion having good effects comes from this social component of it. And so if you preserve everything about religion except going to a weekly meeting and hanging out with some people and having something in common with them, then you've got all the bad parts of religion, without the redeeming thing of giving people a group to be part of. Now, your other question was, let's see, I tabled it, but what was the other question? It was the harder one.
So I was wondering, has the relationship between politics and religion been the same across time?
Yeah, no. No, it is not. I mean, well, here's one big thing, is that throughout most of human history, you've got one religion and one politics, really. And if you are against either, you're dead. Mm. But, there's a little bit of wiggle room, but not much. You can be, in medieval England, you can say, well, we should move just a little bit more pro-France, a little bit anti-France, and you don't get your head chopped off. But you sound like you probably had a good education in the history of England and just read about all the ministers who fell out on the wrong side of the king and lost their heads. And it's like, can't they just tell him to retire? No, they have to die, right? This is normal. And of course, normally, historically, you have a complete fusion of religion and politics. There are some interesting variations, like in the Catholic world, normally the church has greater independence relative to the temporal power. In the Eastern Orthodox world, the church was traditionally totally subordinated to the temporal power. And then really what Protestantism wind up doing was to give the secular leaders the upper hand over religion. And then once that happened in the Protestant areas, tended to happen in the Catholic areas too. But yeah, the modern world is really pretty anomalous, where, especially the modern West, where religion is basically has so much lost favor, and then politics has expanded to fulfill a lot of the previous functions of religion. It's changed a lot over time. Even now is pretty different from when I was a kid. So when I was a kid, you would still see politicians pandering to religion and really trying to go and get their favor, because they still had a sense that there's a lot of people care about religion. Now you really do see a lot more pandering the other way, of churches trying to tell politicians and politically minded people, oh, this is an inclusive church. I didn't see any of that when I was a kid. There was politicians saying, well, we need to make sure we don't offend the Methodists. And what would offend them? Well, let's find out. Now it's the Methodists are worried about offending the LGBT community. It's wow, that's weird. Not how things were when I was a kid.
You're also a strong proponent of open borders. What is one valid criticism that you think holds true against open borders?
There are endless valid criticisms, honestly. Anytime someone says, well, this person got murdered by an immigrant. If there's no immigration, that person would have been murdered. Like, yeah, that's true. Right now, in terms of the big ones that are correct, that's the, you know, the you know, that is where I am much less sympathetic. I mean, the main thing that I do say is that the gains of open immigration are so vast that all the complaints really do look like rounding errors and what I call morbid thinking, the opposite of wishful thinking, where you just let your fantasy run away with you and say, wow, things could get really bad. I can imagine it. It's like, yeah, well, human imagination is infinite. I can imagine it being terrible too. In terms of the main criticisms that you actually get, so there, you know, there is, of course, the fiscal burden of immigration. Or actually, you know, let me back up. There is the one of immigrants are going to take our jobs, and that's going to be terrible. This is the one where basic economics is so strongly against it. Not to say that no one ever loses their job to an immigrant, of course they do, but to say this is a reasonable way to set economic policy. It is as ridiculous as saying, gee, tractors are going to go and disemploy farmers, so let's stop tractors. Or ChatGPT is going to go and disemploy people who do telework. So, or, you know, so let's not do that, right? You know, number one principle of economics. Yeah, actually, if your listeners ignore everything else I say, listen up. Here's the most important fundamental lesson of economics. The secret of mass consumption is mass production. The secret of mass consumption is mass production. Whenever we are thinking about any economic change, we should be asking ourselves, what is it that's going to give us highest production? And that is then going to resolve everything else. You might say, what about distribution? Here's what we know from all of human history, all of economic history. Any large increase in production is widely shared. Right? There is no such thing as a large increase in production that only benefits a small fraction of the population. The Industrial Revolution did not just benefit factory owners. The internet did not just benefit computer programmers. Vaccines did not just benefit pharmaceutical companies. Anytime there's a large increase in production, the benefits are always widely shared, which means that you really should just not focus on distribution and focus on production. Right. So that is the, you know, general view about all complaints about immigrants or taking jobs or something like that, is that this is the mindset that would have left us at the level of the caveman. We should be focusing on figuring out ways to get the production of humanity up as high as possible, because this is what human well-being depends upon. And yes, are there losers? Of course there are losers. There are losers for all progress, and we need to steel ourselves and not think about that much. All right, so anyway, that's my general story about why that kind of complaint about immigration is not relevant. Again, not that these specific complaints are wrong, but just that they are so misguided and such a wrong priority. Now, in terms of the other ones that people talk about, so fiscal effects of immigration, this is one where it's really complicated math. People form strong views based upon philosophy without any math. You shouldn't do that. You should look at math to form opinions about math. I have looked at the math for the US in terms of what is the net fiscal effect of immigration. The most boring standard estimates say that current immigration is a net fiscal positive for the US, but that there are some groups that are net negatives, especially the high school dropouts look like they're net negatives, even if they come at the optimal age. But this is one where, first of all, the negative is not hugely negative. We don't go and stop the birth of people who are net fiscal negatives, and we can predict those people too. So this is a strange thing to say. But anyway, more importantly, it's really easy to change those numbers just by changing the eligibility of immigrants for benefits and that kind of thing. Right then, you know, there's, you know, cultural harm. This is super vague. But by the kinds of culture that we can measure, I say that immigrants are not so different. And second of all, assimilation is high. And then finally, there are worries about the political effects of immigration. These are ones where, again, people will point to things that are very minor compared to the benefits and act like it decides the issue. I've had a lot of people say, like, without immigration, there wouldn't have been Brexit. It's like, all right, well, is Brexit so bad that it would have been better to go and keep millions of people trapped in poverty? I don't see why. Or when people have said, look, well, it's because of immigration that we have Trump. My reaction is, yeah. Well, the main bad thing about Trump is that he's anti-immigration. So to go and have adopted those policies in advance in order to go and prevent his election would seem to be a very foolish path, in my view. So yes, now you might say, well, can you be absolutely sure that immigration won't go and fundamentally change the politics of the country and lead to its total destruction? And that's where I'll say, well, I can't be absolutely sure, but seems super paranoid and unlikely. Where are the examples in human history where this has occurred? I do know of a few cases, but they are so extreme in other measures that, yeah, I'm not worried about this happening in any of the countries that currently receive a lot of immigrants.
Thank you for listening to this first part of our conversation with Professor Brian Kaplan. Tune in on Monday to hear more about why he thinks we should have more kids, his book Don't Be a Feminist, and his views on public education and public housing.